a Sunday evening, Ben Bernanke arranged for the purchase of Bear Stearns by J.P. Morgan right across the street in Midtown Manhattan. I think the transaction was at $1. Okay. And what that essentially created, you know, talk about moral hazard.
Yeah.
It started to create this sense. So everyone knew we had a problem. Yeah. There was a bailout culture. Yeah. Had Bear Stearns gone down, yes, there would have been, it would have been a front page news article. Yeah. I don't believe a systemic collapse of the world financial system would have resulted. I think it would have created a culture of this can be managed.
That was John Morrison, and this is the All Things Risk Podcast. Welcome, or welcome back, as the case may be. This is the All Things Risk Podcast. My name is Ben Cattaneo. This is my show, where in each episode, I sit down with fascinating people in long-form conversation format, and we explore the themes of risk, resilience, uncertainty, randomness, across all manner of life and domains, things like art, sport, current affairs, travel, and many other areas. Today, we are going to get into the global economy and the world's financial system. We're going to talk about things like the global financial crisis of 2007 and 08 and explore whether or not we think the system is any safer. We are going to touch on some things like interest rate swaps and derivatives, but let me stop you right there. Because if you are about to switch off because you don't understand any of this sort of stuff, don't do that. Or conversely, if you are one of those people who are about to crack open a spreadsheet or get your calculator out, put that stuff away. Because my guest today is John Morrison. John is an economist. He's a risk manager. He's currently a director at Credit Suisse. He has had an illustrious career that's included being in the eye of the financial storm that was the 2007-08 financial crisis. And the reason why I asked John to join me as a guest is because not only is he one of the smartest people I know, but he is a great storyteller. He has a Michael Lewis-esque quality around explaining complex things in ways that are easy for people to understand. And they say that if you can do that, you truly have grasped the subject matter. He's a very talented storyteller. I can almost imagine him hosting his own television show or podcast. You'll get a lot out of it and you'll find it very entertaining. We talk about the 2007-08 global financial crisis, the causes, what it was like being in the midst of all of that, where he had to very much keep his head screwed on while everyone was losing theirs in that sort of Rudyard Kipling-esque manner. We talk about the system now, the financial system now, whether or not it's safer. How might the next financial crisis come about? We do talk about Michael Lewis and his books, so books like The Big Short. We speculate. I ask him about whether or not he thinks it's possible to predict the next financial crisis. And then we talk about some things that are emerging, some trends. We talk about the shadow economy, innovations in finance, things like high-frequency trading, virtual currencies like Bitcoin and the technology that sits behind it, blockchain, which you'll hear more and more in the news. Are we moving to a cashless society? And we also philosophize about risk in general, drawing from Nassim Taleb's book, The Black Swan. And John is also a bit of a film buff, so he also drops some good film recommendations. It's appropriate that this podcast was recorded in an undisclosed location somewhere in the city of London, the world's financial capital. Word of warning, though, we did get interrupted twice. So if it sort of stops and starts, I think I've smoothed that over. But if it does do that at the beginning, around the first 15 minutes or so, that's why. It doesn't really disrupt the conversation flow. I think you'll learn a lot, and I think you'll enjoy the way John explains things. So I think this is just was a great conversation that many of you will get a lot out of. Without any further delay, ladies and gentlemen, here is John Morrison. Enjoy. But I think it is appropriate that we are in the city. So I think, one of the smartest people I know and one of the people that can explain kind of complex financial stuff to in a way that that people can easily digest, which is, I think, a sign of expertise, really.
We might dispel that.
We'll try that. But so John, you are a, I don't know, how do you introduce yourself? Somebody asks you, what do you do? Like, what do you do?
I normally get fairly tribal. First of all, describe that I work in risk, and I work in investment banking in London.
Yep.
It then leads on to which investment bank.
Yep.
And given my accent, why are you in London? Yep. because on the surface, it's not clear that I am British.
Yep.
It took me 8 years to get to this point. And my journey,
you clearly didn't start out that way.
My journey started undergraduate, middle of America, University of Oklahoma.
Right. Okay. Is that where you grew up?
Well, in different parts of the Midwest.
Okay.
So my father was in aviation.
Right.
And so we moved around quite a bit.
Okay.
But in centers of aviation, such as Wichita, Kansas, Salina, Kansas, exotic locations.
Absolutely. Okay.
And ending up in Oklahoma.
Okay.
So
okay.
There were various points in between. I think I always knew early on I wanted to study economics.
Right.
There are a whole variety of reasons for that. Maybe too much American public television. so for the sins I had went for the sins of my parents, I went into the study of economics.
American public television is great, isn't it?
I suppose it's pretty much all you have.
Yeah, right.
At that point, it's much better on this side of the pond.
Okay, I was thinking about like NPR and stuff like that.
Yeah, I don't even recall a history with National Public
Radio. Right. Okay. Okay. You're talking about three networks.
I found public television. You were bombarded with both, themes from the political right, political
right,
left.
Right, yeah.
So you could grow up with a bit of the late William F. Buckley.
Yeah.
You could, on the other side, Kenneth Galbraith would
right,
be offering,
right.
you know, X, Y, and Z. So, of course, I got, you know, love that stuff.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
I'm not sure I knew that I was going to translate into a career in banking, but my very first job after undergraduate was with a bank.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what happens. You
mm-hmm.
join a bank training program,
mm-hmm.
and they try to find a spot that's right for you.
Mm-hmm.
I found that loan underwriting, that is, meeting with clients and underwriting loans, was not for me when I had my first loan loss.
Yeah. Right. Okay.
I realized, maybe.
Yeah.
So I went into, essentially, at that point, rotating through the bank. Well, let's try moving over to the trading side.
Right.
The whole underwriting, meeting with clients, lending money wasn't my thing. But eventually it was always, as we do in the States, after a couple of years, you go and you go to graduate school.
Right, right.
So I think I always knew I was going to go to Chicago.
Right.
University of Chicago was my choice.
Mm-hmm.
Not the other one,
mm-hmm.
Northwestern,
mm-hmm.
don't speak of them. and reinforce my knowledge of finance and economics. In the States, an MBA is a important part of one's, what we call resume,
CV. Yeah.
You can't really get through certain doors without it. It's simply the currency mm-hmm. of advancing.
Mm-hmm.
After graduate school, at that time Coopers & Lybrand, which became mm-hmm. PricewaterhouseCoopers,
mm-hmm.
said, would you like to move to New York and be mm-hmm. a consultant to financial services? You've worked in banking.
Right.
You could bring that skill set, et cetera. And I thought, oh, fabulous.
Yeah.
The money was good.
Yeah.
And off I went to New York.
Living the life.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And one of my clients was a relatively small investment bank owned by a German parent.
Mm-hmm.
I think I can mention names.
Mm-hmm.
They don't even exist anymore.
Right.
Kleinwort Benson, which became Dresdner Kleinwort.
Right.
Benson became Dresdner Kleinwort Wasserstein.
Okay.
Became iterations after that.
Wanted to spend a bit of time on a couple of things. You said you got involved in the trading side a little bit, and I'm just wondering what that was like, because You look at these traders who are they seem to run on adrenaline. It appears. It's also very popular. I mean, I think if you took the demographic, so it's very male, I think. And number two is that it's also a very kind of there's a high percentage of athletes in trading or ex-athletes. I mean, I think the England rugby players, or I can't remember who it is, but there is a high level of athletes who kind of. Maybe they translate that sort of playing a game, that adrenaline rush, and making those quick decisions to trading. Did you take to it, or did you notice the same sort of thing? Or,
well, I should stress there are different types of traders.
Sure.
Now, I was in one class of trader. Now, when you work for a large Midwestern bank, trading is quite different in that respect. So the products are much the same. So in that sort of situation, you have much more of a client-focused trading responsibility. You have a client, they typically have a loan with that particular bank, a large one, and they have the need to maybe hedge interest rate or FX risk.
Okay.
So the trading is very simple paper.
Right.
Okay, a interest rate swap of X number of years. It's not that sort of high-powered thing that you see in film.
Right.
Now,
so it's basically like, so when you say interest rate swap, like some people will be like, oh, you're dropping some mad science on me here.
It's very simple. Think of yourself as you're a client, and your business has expanded globally, and because of that expansion, you find that you are amazingly now a captive to risk, that is, changes in foreign exchange rates. You have a plant in Mexico, in Canada, and suddenly you need to hedge this sort of risk. It's something you don't have to worry about if you're simply dealing in U.S. dollars.
Yeah.
And so so when you say trader for those banks in the middle of America, huge banks in the Midwest, it's a much more of a friendly client facilitation role.
Okay. Your friendly neighborhood banker.
Now, when I moved to New York, it was it was suddenly trading floors as you see in film.
Yes.
Okay. Much more adrenaline based. Now, trading has evolved since then. Back in those days, proprietary trading. What I mean by proprietary trading, where you're trading on
the
bank's money.
Created
a certain type of trader, kings of the kings
yeah
of
the
world,
big sort of. The big swinging dicks, as as Michael Lewis would say.
Exactly.
We'll get into Michael Lewis and The Big Short and his wonderful stories, but I think that is very
and New York traders differ from London traders.
Right.
Okay. There's a difference there,
right,
as well. Much more, I'd say, bravado in New York. I think in London, the evolution of trading had moved much more. This pendulum has swung much more back to client facilitation.
Okay.
And then there was regulation there as well, basically.
Okay.
For all intents and purposes, strong controls, elimination of proprietary trading.
Right.
Not really elimination, but moving it offshore.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Out of the United States.
Right.
So, taking the casino out of banking, if you will.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I just want to stress there are different.
Yeah.
Different breed of trader.
Sure.
Yes, male dominated.
Mm-hmm.
Nugget jewelry in some cases.
Right.
large watches.
Yeah.
That sort of thing.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. That's we'll get into some of these themes in a moment. But I wanted to maybe start with a discussion about the global financial crisis and what happened in 2007, 2008. At least your interpretation of it. First of all, where were you when that was happening? What were you doing?
Yeah, I think for depending on what institution you were in, what part of the financial services chain you were in, what part of the food chain, the crisis began at different times and in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
So at that time, I was working for an investment bank in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people can trace, some of us can trace back to early 2007 when a few banks began to notice that their subprime portfolios were deteriorating.
Yes.
Now, subprime, it wasn't widely known what that was.
Mm-hmm.
Subprime was essentially taking American single-family homes, bundling them together, and those individuals who own those homes have different repayment prospects.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Some will remain employed, others won't. And so the risk of these pools is the composition of all these individuals, and there was a deterioration.
Yep.
People couldn't maintain their payments. And we began seeing this evolution early 2017. Mm. I recall even the name, the first bank that said they had a problem. Mm. HSBC in America said, we have a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And it began to filter through, and our institution had a very large concentration in those mortgage-backed securities. So we began to feel it immediately.
Mm-hmm.
Now, others in the industry will talk about Lehman Brothers, which came much later. And for us, we had already begun to suffer significant losses. I recall very clearly, it was Halloween 2007, long before Lehman. There was an industry called monoline insurers.
Mm-hmm.
These were large institutions, AAA rated by rating agencies.
Yeah.
Their sole purpose was to offer their credit standing and wrapping, what we call wrapping or bringing security to essentially instruments that would have been dodgy otherwise.
Yeah.
So bundling of subprime mortgages, etc.
When you talk about the bundling of subprime mortgages, I mean, and I'm not a banker, and the people listening to this probably aren't largely bankers, but effectively you have this, you package things together, and it's that whole, you know, that whole notion of, you know, not all your eggs in one basket. That's the whole thing. That's why you have portfolios. That's, you know, that, and that's this whole concept of risk diversification. But you know, these are nominally smart people. So when that was going on, why did so few kind of put up their hands and say, look, this doesn't really feel right. We should get out of this. I mean, you know. Normally you're saying, well, you know, these people, you know, they're all different homes, and therefore not everyone's going to not be able to make their payments. If you spread it out, then, you know, we'll be fine. But actually, you know, if interest rates go up as they did, then a whole bunch of people won't be able to pay, and it'll all unravel. So why don't, you know, these are...
I think it's a combination of things. Now we can laugh a little bit about it, but at that time, what we call financial engineering, what it was at its height.
Yeah.
The use of modeling.
Yes.
And not fully understanding or not fully disclosing all of the assumptions in the model. Okay.
Mm.
There was also behavioral aspects. So if you structure these things, your bonus, your income benefits immediately.
Yes.
And these are instruments with a very long maturity.
Yes.
But you as a person,
you sell a bundle of these things, and you've got a nice bonus or whatever.
Absolutely.
And okay. It's someone else's problem.
Right. Yeah. The other party in this exchange are the rating agencies.
Yes.
So Moody's, S&P, Fitch.
Yeah.
They bring their expertise to independently analyze the credit worthiness of that structure. At the very same time, their livelihood is the fee income of me coming to them and saying, I will pay you £5 million if you will offer your credit opinion on this structure and be independent.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Using many of the same models.
Yes.
Okay. So again, financial engineering, it's not financial engineering gone mad. There's nothing inherently wrong with modeling.
Sure.
You have to understand the assumptions.
Yes.
Okay. You have to understand... what does a AAA mean? Mm. What are the criteria?
All right. So we had a little disruption. Somebody was calling from Stockholm. It looked like in this room. Anyway,
I was just mentioning there's nothing inherently wrong with modeling.
Yeah.
If you understand the assumptions
of
the model, clearly bring everyone's attention to them, and everyone can make a educated decision about how much they want to rely on the model output.
Yeah.
There's nothing unreasonable there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. But at that time, there was a lot of incentives. There was a certain inertia and momentum in the market. Okay,
yeah.
These things, which had been all the rage in 2004 through 2006, began to experience some difficulties.
Yeah.
Those companies that had offered their services to credit back those began to, default, fail.
Yes. Yeah.
Many of those monolines, most of those monolines, I won't even mention names. They don't even exist anymore.
Yeah.
Okay. Those names are just they've just been eliminated from the landscape.
Right.
Right.
Right. So monoline is what exactly?
A monoline is a well-capitalized financial services company who brings significant equity in wrapping transactions into simply blessing them and simply saying, if the structure fails, if this instrument fails, my credit backing is going to support that.
Yeah.
Okay. And the rating agencies rate them too.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, the problem is if everything hits them at the same time, they fail.
Yeah, they fail.
Then they fail.
Yeah.
They no longer exist.
Yeah. So. There we go. Okay. Sorry, second interruption that you won't catch on the air, but we're back. Right. So, monolines, they back. They're effectively the guarantors of some of these things.
And they profited.
Yeah.
But obviously they receive a fee for wrapping. So there was a whole play of actors.
It's all perverse incentives, right? It's just...
But at the time, it seems all credible.
Right.
An independent rating agency, a monoline bringing their financial backing to a transaction, the investor benefiting from all of these sets of eyes, but all of them a little misaligned with respect to incentives.
Yeah. Yeah.
We now know better.
Yeah, okay. Well, yeah, I did want to talk about that. But then things started to really melt down.
Absolutely.
In,
so,
2008,
our bank continued to hemorrhage losses.
Yeah.
Eventually, it would play out... we had such a large cumulative loss that our parent sold us.
Right, okay. Right.
It was much, much easier to exit.
Yeah.
The German government was even involved at one point.
Right,
so even governments had to get involved to encourage buyers to come for these.
That worked really well.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And what's the psychology in an organization experiencing something like that? What, you know, are people... You know, jumping out of windows, and you know what was the obviously the mood wasn't very good. But what was that? What did that?
This
feel
is going
like?
To sound really odd. Mm. I was working in the risk organization, so my job was not to underwrite and create new business, but I'd been asked to help manage our way out of this. So I was asked to move from New York to London, where we were experiencing.
Yeah.
So our losses were essentially moving across the pond.
Sure.
They started in New York, and then they continued in London.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, in the risk function, times were never better.
Yeah.
Now, what I mean? No, it's really
it gets
even more perverse because there I am in the risk function attempting to put out fires. So it's exciting work.
Yes.
At the same time, my institution is under severe stress, and packages are handed out to critical individuals to encourage them not to leave.
Mm.
So I think you will find. If you talk to more and more risk people about the crisis, they never prospered more than they did at the height of the crisis.
Okay. Yeah. Mm.
So it was essentially paying risk people more
Put out fires.
Paying the fireman not to leave the scene.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, absolutely.
Stay at the scene, put out the fire, etc.
Yeah. Okay. That's certainly interesting, and as a, you know, as a risk guy, I revel in chaos at times as well. So you know, I do get that.
It was literally 7 days a week.
Sure.
And as a new arrival in London, don't necessarily know anyone.
Yeah.
Don't know where the Great West End shows are. For me, it was like 7 days a week.
I'm there.
I'm there. Right.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So we then. went into the world economy kind of went into this big funk, then we got all these responses to what happened, and that seemed to involve a whole lot of regulations and a lot of scrutiny on the banks. I guess one of the things that I think I want to get into, you know, what was done and whether or not we're safer in a moment. But I think what did happen, certainly things like the bailouts, not just in banking, but, you know, in other industries, the automotive industry, for example, I think that really rubbed so many people the wrong way for obvious reasons. And obviously the world of finance is connected to the real economy as well. So that led to recession and job losses and all that stuff. And that probably, you know, in terms of being a banker, that's probably the last thing around that time that you wanted to tell people. It's really the sort of the privatization of the gains and the socialization of the losses that I think you know, rub a lot of people the wrong way. But from your perspective, I wanted to maybe explore whether or not, what are your views on that? And just as a, you know, from a, not just from your organizational hat, but maybe from a societal perspective on.
Yeah, I certainly have some views, and these are my personal views. I feel like I was close enough to some of these aspects I can speak fairly responsibly about them. Not everyone will share what I'm about to say. So when I was in New York, right before moving to London, I was basically packing up. There was a financial institution, the name may ring a bell, Bear Stearns.
Yes.
It was a pure investment bank play. Yes. No one deposited money with Bear Stearns. It wasn't, it didn't offer systemic risk to little depositors, so mom and pops weren't going to be injured if this bank failed. And it ran into severe financial problems because of subprime.
Yeah.
Now, it's my personal view. This happened on a Sunday. It was clear they were not going to be able to open on Monday. My personal view is the Fed lost their nerve. The view was it would create such systemic risk that they the system couldn't stand it. I think that was fundamentally wrong. I believe that people understood Bear Stearns' risk profile. That there were certain firms that were going to be severely tested by that downturn. And it wasn't mom and pops. It was other financial institutions, hedge funds, asset managers, and that sort of thing. On a Sunday evening, Ben Bernanke arranged for the purchase of Bear Stearns by J.P. Morgan right across the street in Midtown Manhattan. I think the transaction was at $1. Okay. And what that essentially created, you know, talk about moral hazard.
It
started to create this sense. So everyone knew we had a problem. There was a bailout culture. Had Bear Stearns gone down, yes, there would have been, it would have been a front page news article. I don't believe a systemic collapse of the world financial system would have resulted. I think it would have created a culture of this can be managed. The United States
Would you not think it was a little bit too late at that time?
I think for in the United States, okay, they have a established protocol around bank failure. It's managed by the FDIC. It's managed by the Office of Controller of Currency, which is Treasury Department, Federal Reserve, etc. The bank failures are not new to the United States. So you can look it up on Wikipedia. Big ones. Dating back to Penn Square, Continental Illinois.
I grew up in, I'm Canadian, grew up in Canada. I mean, we have like six or seven banks in Canada. Like you go, you can just choose one. It's, they're all kind of the same. But in the States, you have like thousands of thousands and thousands. I'm sure they all go, you know, belly up. Every year there are banks that
you can go check this out on the FDIC web, the FDIC website. There's a bank. Most of them are small, granted. Bear Stearns was unique in that depositors would not have been eviscerated by that failure. It created this little moral hazard, and and the underlying problems were still there. Okay, and so we end up in a bit of a situation where the Fed's played its hand, and it's quite clear that it's going to play a certain way. Now, it becomes quite interesting at the time of the Lehman Brothers failure. I'm not a conspiracy nut. I just think there was a whole series of blunders. Okay, it was Bear Stearns who should have been gone, creating the culture that we're not going to do these bailouts, etc. So Lehman, I think, was a cross between a policy blunder that was a blunder made so by the Bear Stearns event, which preceded it by over a year. Okay, then it went into very odd territory. There was the Federal Reserve bailout of AIG, an insurance company. Now, this people began to really wonder about this. Why would the Federal Reserve, which had no mandate, bail out an insurance company? It turns out they were a significant player in what's called the credit default swap market. Okay, and had AIG failed, it's quite clear there were a couple of European banks, and particularly one I worked for. But there was a firm called Goldman Sachs. It would have been, I think it's fair to say, would have had a hole in their balance sheet so large that they would have likely failed. So we had a whole series of very odd bailouts occurring. And where does it stop?
And, you know, at that point, I imagine, and I don't know what was going on in these people's minds, but I imagine it's, you know, so chaotic that you know, the information is out of date after 5 minutes. So So I guess I can understand that. And for people that don't understand this concept, moral hazard just basically means that, if you have a moral hazard, it means that you think that somebody's going to either bail you out, or you think that, you know, daddy's going to pay the bill effectively. So you're going to go out and, do whatever, crash right. the car, or whatever. So you're going to take more chances because, as I said, daddy's going to come in and help you out. Exactly. And it's hard. It's hard for a policymaker, because actually, if you do crash the car, lots of other bad things can happen. Mm-hmm. So what do you do? And there's this thing called constructive ambiguity, where they call it. Oh, it's a wonderful term. Like these terms are, they're so esoteric. But it just basically means you want to put enough doubt in there that there's no guarantee that they're going to bail you out. So you're careful. So. Very hard to do in practice. But did I get that?
No, absolutely. And a lot of things have happened since then. I think policymakers, regulators, and banks there's some sense of what happened. Maybe mm-hmm. not necessarily the causes and effects mm-hmm. and all of the who's responsible for what. Yeah. And so there's basically been a movement to. Get rid of, get rid of or manage what had been called too big to fail.
Yeah.
Okay. that we would create a situation where now banks, it's perceived they're yeah. much better capitalized.
Yeah.
That there's a resolution recovery protocol. Mm-hmm. Okay. So these are terms that, they were called resolution, yeah. living wills was the original term.
Right.
That there's now a sense that a large institution can fail without bringing down the entire financial
sure.
system.
Okay.
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 Now, that hasn't been tested.
Yeah.
And
touch with.
I think that the lessons from the 2007 onward period are that for example, Ben, if you discovered, you saw the news, there's some sort of event in the stock market, and Goldman Sachs has failed.
Yes.
You'd probably be a little concerned.
You would, yeah.
Right? Because you're thinking, wait,
what else is going to fail?
Because they were always sort of the favored bank.
Yeah.
They always seemed, there was the AIG bailout as an example. Mm-hmm. The fact that a lot of policymakers mm-hmm. used to work at Goldman or vice mm-hmm. versa. People, mm-hmm. policymakers go to Goldman.
Sure, sure.
So they're almost about...
that's something else that, that also creates perhaps some perverse incentives.
Yeah. You mentioned perverse incentives. There's even a popular film out now. The Big Short, based on a book by Michael Lewis, where certain individuals in the Goldman trading operation seem to be profiting from positions that other parts of the bank had sold on to mm-hmm. the client. So mm-hmm. these are
what are your views on that? Is it plausible?
Certainly, banks are big institutions. The business lines are not necessarily always aligned.
Yeah.
For example, there are walls between different parts of the organization. So I guess an author can take something that is standard or par for the course, and it looks pretty bad from the outside. I'm not saying what Goldman did was fine.
Yeah.
Simply saying that if you have part of the institution, their job is to, say, support and provide financing to hedge fund clients. It's perfectly sane. Everyone would say that's a financing activity. If at the other time some other part of the bank, using different information, is taking positions opposite those hedge funds, I think most people would say, well, if they're not talking, that's fine. But it makes for great. I haven't seen the film yet.
Yeah.
It's a good read.
Yeah.
Michael Lewis is a great
author. Great storyteller.
He takes financial services and makes it consumable.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's what I love. I love his stuff.
I can argue with certain aspects, but he gets the gist right.
Yes.
So if you read like his latest Flash Boys, which is about high frequency trading, mm-hmm. For my partner, she has nothing to do with financial services. She works in an entirely different industry. I handed her the book. And she said, high frequency trading. I have no interest in it. I said,
but it's riveting stuff,
pages,
isn't it?
Yeah. And she was hooked.
Yeah, yeah.
She was like, I have to finish this.
One of my favorite of his books is Moneyball, and I don't like baseball. I really don't. I don't get baseball. I don't like it. But that book is fascinating. Mm-hmm. If you have a bit of if you wanted a sense of what the financial services world is like, you know, pick up anything by Michael Lewis. The Big Short's good, Flash Boys, and then Liar's Poker, which was written way back in the 90s, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think for those who have read Flash Boys, and even if you haven't, I think I've already thought about a film adaptation.
Right.
So you know the Ocean's 11, 12 yes. series, which are the editing for that film, it's like almost for those who have a short attention span. It's like moves from Brad Pitt to George Clooney to all these characters. It would work perfectly because the book is based around people who are seemingly unrelated working on the perimeters of this problem, this interesting feature of high-frequency trading, not necessarily knowing each other. I think it'd be perfect adaptation of...
High-frequency trading is all about like using the power of, you know, the internet, digital communications, to make trades, and you could make so much money by nanoseconds. If you execute one trade that's in a spot that's closer to a server or whatever, you all of a sudden you can make huge amounts of money.
Absolutely. So in equities, so stock.
Yeah.
Okay. Equities trading. There are exchanges. There used to only be the New York Stock Exchange and a couple of others.
Yep.
There are now lots of exchanges, and the speed of light enters into it.
Yeah.
So a little bit of just some simple Einstein and relativity that there's a certain speed in a straight line, and you found that in the world of fiber optics, people were laying cable in very straight lines. They were buying out properties. Like, why would anyone pay so much money for some ridiculous property in the middle of New Jersey? And you found out that somebody was developing a fiber optic line because essentially they wanted to be faster than someone else.
Yes.
Now, the end result was that all sorts of strange behavior, not necessarily in the benefit of the client, the investor, were fostered. The book will tell all.
It's a fascinating topic as well. Also, it's really interesting about, you know, we've got the so-called digital or virtual economy, but actually it's very dependent on physical infrastructure.
Exactly.
which is certainly it's topic for some another episode. I want to talk about whether or not things are safer. Before we get into that, I wanted to just ask you a question about, it's going to sound a little bit, also a little bit esoteric, but values, ethics, you know, doing the right thing, people having a moral compass in the world of investment banking, does that exist at all? Is there a place for that, or is it just brutal and ruthless? Or does it rely on mostly institutions working?
It's institutions making an effort. So, as I mentioned, I was in banking. I went into consulting and consulted with banks. And then one of those banks said, would you like to join us? Now, one of the key elements of the framework of how I made my decision was, do I like the culture?
Yeah.
Okay. There are lots of banks I could potentially go work for. Why was this one so special? It was one that I felt like was paying more than lip service to values, to a corporate culture.
Sure.
So this institution I now work for has 10 culture statements that senior management truly believe in. And while everyone needs to be educated in those and kind of gather around them, I do see it's an institution where people are beginning to live those values, right? Simple things, do things correctly, think about the net impact of whatever you're saying. Would you like it said in a public forum?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So for traders, okay, if you're in a particular trading chat room sponsored by a third party, would you want that published on the front page of the Times or the Telegraph or the Guardian?
Yeah.
It's a very simple rule, that sort of thing.
Sure, sure.
So I do think it's institution by institution, and it has changed. I used to think when I was in banking before that institution had a certain moral compass, and I've discovered that its compass was a little off. Okay.
Yeah.
And but you don't know it at the time.
Yeah.
It comes later. Had you told me in 2007, would you go to a course and and have corporate culture statements plastered all over the wall on the trading floor. I would have said that's a bit silly. We're trying to survive. Yeah. Right? Now it seems they're a constant reminder. So when I arrive in the office, there's two different entrances. Those culture statements are actually right there in front of you in a very nice mural and display. Now you might say, "Oh, this is a bunch of signs, right?
Whatever, whitewash. It's not greenwash, but it's your BS stuff."
But that starts filtering through other things. Yeah. Compensation in banking is evolving.
Mm. I think that's probably the critical bit, right?
It's absolutely. Like getting the way in which discretion. So in banking, you have your salary, and you hope to earn with hard work, working 7 days a week. Those carefully placed emails on a Sunday. That you'll get a large bonus or discretionary payment. There's deferrals now. Mm. Okay, what does the deferral mean? It means we're going to give you some shares in the company that you work for, payable over a period of time. Okay. There's even variations. Some institutions took all of that toxic, all those toxic securities, bundled them together, said, "You underwrote it here, you have a piece of it, if you really believe it, that's your bonus."
Yeah.
Some of those turned out not so bad, had a slight positive return. So I think through the compensation channel.
Yeah. So I think that's important. Having skin in the game is really, would you put your own money on this? Would you stake the welfare of your future, your family and your kids, then it starts to become real. Otherwise it is the casino.
And people in risk, that is people who are supposed to look after the soundness of the bank. Traders are there for revenue generation. They're all supposed to look after the soundness. But for those people like myself who are in the risk space, one thing that's happened is we now find more of our compensation in the form of fixed salary.
Right.
To basically not put us in a situation where we are fostering, so we hope to benefit from that revenue upside. And that happened in the 2004 to 2006 period. I think you would talk to most risk managers and their goal was to facilitate and foster business. Mm-hmm. They would always use terms like, we still want to control losses and that sort of thing, but I think the incentives were wrong, were messed up, I think, for some degree for everyone.
Yes.
So there's been corrections in that.
Right, okay. I mean, it's something that I think these are very positive moves from on the part of banks and regular, certainly your employer.
But you've
got to stay vigilant, right? Yeah. It's things change.
I'm reminded
of a story of another friend of mine who's an investment bank, and he was on some regulatory course to get some license or whatever. And his comment was very interesting because this is pre-financial crisis, but it was everyone in the room was interested in whatever the regulation was, and the questions were always like, "Oh, if I did this and I did that, is that okay? Could I get away with that?" It was trying to find the little loopholes around the regulations to do whatever they were trying to do.
Absolutely. I mean, I've been to those courses, and they'll play these examples that are, and I think half of the room says, "Oh, it's quite clear you need to take this action, remedy X."
Yes.
The other half are saying, "I don't even see the problem."
Yes. Yeah.
Then you've seen the same. They often show a little film, a setting, and it's. I'm often surprised by the different reactions in the room.
Yeah.
But I was also going to add that this year I was reminded again that in many ways probably life hasn't moved on that much in some areas of banking, because so in the month of January, it's after Christmas, right? After the holiday season, a month where there is no excess, right? But I started noticing this year again the proliferation of middle of January, late January, the proliferation of watch advertisements, inserts in the newspaper, the London Yacht and Boat Show.
Sure.
Okay, and you begin to think, that's a strange January.
Yeah.
You've just spent all this money on Christmas, and then I was like, oh, I'm in the city. Now, you won't find a watch insert in the Dallas Morning News, right?
No.
It's not going to happen. But you here in London, in New York, you'll see. And I was just sort of chuckling myself.
Yes. Yes. And yeah, watches, Mont Blanc pens, and whatever else.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. No, that's that is interesting. Have you read that book, The Hour Between Dog and Wolf?
I have not.
You haven't. So this is a book about. So it's a neurobiologist who was also a trader, and he did a whole bunch of experiments about the what happens chemically in the brain to traders. And what happens is that they make a successful trade, and then all this kind of dopamine floods into the system, and they start, you know, you start to feel like, you know, the ego starts to perk up, you're feeling very confident, and that keeps going, and what happens is you're taking on more and more risk, and up until the point of, you know, a crash of some kind, and then what happens is the other sort of fight or flight chemical, cortisol, takes over the brain, and you don't want to take any risk, and you're kind of on lockdown. And it's just a fascinating look at it, because it's, now we're actually talking about something completely different. It's not just institutions. It's not just, you know, there's another sort of dimension about trying to regulate the mindset of these people. I don't know what, you know, policy wise is anyone can do or banks can do. Although one of the recommendations he had was to get more women in senior positions in banking. But it's an interesting take on it. I don't know if you had any.
I think in many ways those behaviors are much more akin to trading that is largely being eliminated. So
right.
when I talk about proprietary trading,
yeah.
Now also this sort of fixed income trading between one large bank and another over a bit of margin.
Right.
I think you see that sort of behavior.
Yeah.
Where investment banking is really gone, I think you can check with people
they're taking away that kind of stuff.
It's much more of facilitating, because capital is scarce.
Yeah. Yes.
Generating returns on this limited capital is a hard thing to do. You see much more banks focus on, again, I keep mentioning client facilitation.
Yeah.
You have a client that is important to the institution. You provide direct lending. You provide all sorts of investment banking services. And so in those kind of situations, a client facilitation trade looks quite different, because it sounds a little odd, but a client has a risk management need. Maybe it's to hedge FX, interest rate, credit risk.
A large company might be, you know, the whole thing is to lock in a price, right? Yeah. So we're...
And they will come... Why do they even come to a bank? They come to a bank because... We offer a product offering pretty wide. We have a balance sheet.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing in this transaction, to help them risk manage, the bank ends up holding a position, inventory, whatever you want to call it, that it doesn't necessarily want, and consequently needs to hedge itself.
Sure.
Right. So, and it wants to make money in this exchange, either through fee or spread income, et cetera. So that creates a very different style of trading.
Mm.
Okay. It's about servicing the client, managing those positions. I don't know that you have this burst of the chemical reaction.
Yes.
Because you're looking at the client revenue as a whole and your contribution to that, and you're being judged on that,
a bonus
being paid accordingly, et cetera, as opposed to this turnover of trading that you might see in a flow trading.
Yes.
There used to be a concept of flow monster, a bank that'll just pass so many trades through that the spread and fee income, they'll be able to
make
a huge profit.
Okay.
That's, I think that model's largely gone.
Yeah. Okay. It sounds like what you're also saying is that overall the banks are safer and the system is safer. Is that fair to say?
The banks are safer. That's not to say that they're all properly capitalized. If I said to you there's a financial institution has leverage of 10 times, you and it doesn't work in banking would go, that doesn't seem...
It doesn't seem right.
Yeah. It doesn't seem right. But that's the... You know, we are still talking about leverage at those numbers.
Mm.
It's just that there's a bit more capital, right, set aside.
Mm-hmm. Leverage meaning basically debt to use to make investments.
Yeah, so how much of the balance... You know, what's the financing of the left side, the asset side of balance sheet?
Yeah.
What's on the other side? It's still largely debt.
Yeah.
There's much more equity than there used to be. Will that be enough during the next downturn? There's always another downturn. We're going to see.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we're going to test all the protocols.
Right.
Set up.
Right.
We'll see if it's too big to fail.
Okay. Let's see. fingers crossed. So has that been driven largely by regulation, a change in leadership in banks, a combination of things like that? Or sometimes I think, you know, regulation is there are so many regulations on banking and all kinds of things. And you just, you get into this sort of, I imagine if you're, again, it's just, you know, what can I get away with? I mean, there's only so much regulation you can throw at a problem. But, you know,
Regulation's been quite helpful. It's all quite simple. I mean, there's a lot of acronyms, right?
Yes.
Regulations always seem to be an acronym. So MiFID, FRTB,
You need a whole map of
TLAC, on and on. At the heart of it, policymakers and regulators simply told banks, you need to hold a certain amount of capital, and they created little ratios so you can measure it, risk-weighted assets, and something called Tier 1 capital coverage. So basically quite simple. How much capital do you have to sustain your business activities as an arithmetic calculation? It's quite simple. But they set a standard. They said, if you operate in this country, you have to meet the following X criteria. So, yes, that was imposed on banks. There was a little bit of complaining. But the complaining manifests itself in, well, what could we add to the mix that would meet the spirit? And you had interesting new instruments. If we issue this type of debt, could it be counted almost as equity?
Okay. Right.
So there was all, you probably heard about COCOs, which were these convertible bonds. Because it was all about how do we get there but do some more financial engineering. That's largely fallen by the wayside. And consequently, it's all that we now have very robust metrics imposed on banks it's not about getting around them. It's about meeting those standards, issuing new capital to get to those levels to maintain operations.
And I think, one of the things about all this is, if a bank goes bust, again, as we were talking about, you know, it's like if my neighbor's playing with toxic chemicals, that's their choice, but don't burn my house down. And, you know, if we're getting closer to that place, I mean, it's almost impossible to eliminate the kind of perverse incentives completely that are, you know, in, I think, an industry like this. But as long as we're not, other parts of the economy aren't catching fire when there's a problem, then I think things are better. But I don't know whether or not that's the case.
I think most people think there are certain channels that the next crisis will manifest through. They're going to be very different channels than before.
What are some of those?
I think one that I've seen these two words in combination more in the last 90 days than I've seen in years, market liquidity.
Okay.
Now, previously, liquidity was, can you fund yourself, right? Can you raise funds? Can you maintain yourself as whether you're a bank or a mom and pop?
Yeah.
This idea of liquidity and funding yourself. Market liquidity is something very different. That's essentially the liquidity of your assets. That is, if I'm holding a bond, how readily can I sell that bond?
Sure.
And most people look at certain events over the last couple of years. 2014, U.S. Treasuries, which were considered the safe haven on the planet, so short-term debt issued by the U.S. government, 90-day stuff, short maturity. There was actually a liquidity crisis for 13 minutes in October of 2014.
That's sound
a flash crash.
Right.
Okay. This was not supposed to happen. Why did it happen? There was a bit of there's trading algorithms that operate. This is computer code that says sell at this price, buy at that price.
Right.
I'm being somewhat simplistic. Yeah. Recently, Mark Carney, quite appropriately,
the Canadian governor of the Bank of England,
Mark Carney, who is the Canadian head of the Bank of England, commented that they'd done a study, the Bank of England, around this. What caused this flash crash? It turns out that it was probably algos gone mad.
Okay. Algorithms gone mad.
Exactly. So imagine a market liquidity event conjured up not by the actions of individuals, but the interplay of algos all pointing in the same direction, responding to a particular news event.
Right.
do lemmings really throw themselves off a cliff? You could argue that this is like lemmings, and everyone moves to the same side of the ship.
Yeah.
Okay, that sort of event. That's a possibility.
That's interesting.
That's one channel. Mm-hmm. That's a possibility. Mm-hmm. Anything could spook it. Could be China, a continued China.
Yeah.
So anything that...
China's interesting one, and I... Look, so simplistic thing that I wanted to just get your thoughts on. So China grows at whatever it was, 6.9% or whatever, right? And like sometimes I wonder, do people in the markets understand percentages, right? Because if you grow at 7% one year, to maintain that 7% is so much harder the next year and the next year and the year after that. I mean, it's just like, you know, if you make $100 in one year and you want to grow by 10%, next year you have to make 110. The year after that, you have to make 121. Mm-hmm. The year after that, you make 130. It's so much harder. So the growth rate's going to go down. And this, you know, early in the year, markets got a little spooked by China.
China's not really a free market economy. It's a little bit of economy with a bit of free and a bit of fiat.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's it is what it is. I think most most people wouldn't say it very loudly, but nobody really has huge confidence in the
official numbers.
Right?
Yeah.
The other thing that China has a huge, it goes in waves, what we'd essentially call non-performing part of the economy.
Right.
There, these building booms, for example.
Yeah, the ghost cities.
Yeah, so they manifest itself in real estate as empty. Those are written off.
Yeah.
Okay. What kind of economic activity is that? So I think there's a little bit about a doubt about those numbers.
Yeah.
There is an evolution going on in the Chinese economy, and it's not so much that this is the economy needs to adjust itself, and it will be a painful process. People will have to adjust their global growth prospects. It impacts the U.S. It impacts Europe, etc. I think it's the concern I have is obviously the reaction of certain elements of our trading infrastructure, whether it be algorithms, high-frequency trading, that channel through market liquidity could be one of it. The other one is that sounds kind of boring, collateral.
Mm. Okay.
Because of regulation, trades between counterparties, trading whatever instrument, collateral is now often part of the game.
Right.
Now, interesting about collateral, I give you some securities to collateralize that. You actually are holding those securities. You say, oh, I'm going to use those because I'm holding your collateral. Mm. I'm going to support some other activity. Mm. You find these essentially a chain of collateral. Mm-hmm. It goes under different names like hypothecation. Mm-hmm. But basically, collateral changing hands over a period of time.
Okay.
Now, imagine a market event. It's a bit like musical chairs when you were a child at the county fair. Mm-hmm. Okay, the music stops. Mm-hmm. Okay, where's the collateral?
Right.
Okay. So people have commented about this focus on collateral optimization. Is that a channel for systemic risk? Potentially.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, a market event where suddenly people might be calling their collateral. Who's holding the collateral?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. It sounds like science fiction, but it's actually a credible channel.
Right, right.
So those might be.
Okay. I like the musical chairs analogy.
I mean, I'm not a predict. I don't have a crystal ball.
No.
But when I look out there, I see wherever you see these behaviors with the same financial instruments having a certain turnover through different hands, you immediately say, "What would happen in an event?" And you go, "Oh, I might want to worry about that."
Yeah, that is interesting. And did you think that the system is so interconnected that I guess it's difficult to know what's going to happen if you get one of these kinds of events.
And lots of parts of the economy are not, quote, regulated.
Yes.
You probably heard of the shadow banking.
Yes.
Like, what's that about?
What's that
you
about?
Hear Bart Carney or Ben.
What is shadow banking?
Or Yellen and the shadow banking. Yeah. It's pretty straightforward. You can point at them. So here in London, we have hedge funds that are largely, and asset managers largely based in Mayfair.
Mm.
In the States, you'll find them congregated in Greenwich, Connecticut. Mm-hmm. Hedge funds are an important part of our financial system. Hedge funds go bust all the time. Mm-hmm. It's basically people pool their money and make investments.
Mm-hmm.
There's not strict governance because they're a hedge fund, right?
Right.
They're supposed to blow up and nobody bothers, right?
Yeah.
Sometimes they can become incredibly large. And their actions can precipitate events in the non-shadow economy. So people say, well, shouldn't we regulate that? Mm-hmm. It's okay. There's a bit more regulation, right, of the shadow asset managers, hedge funds, but they provide liquidity. They offer other sides of the trade, if you will. Mm-hmm. They have a different view of the world. As always, different views of the world facilitate trading, right? So you'd say that's good that they're there. But you wonder, there could be a systemic risk coming in that direction.
Right.
But if you're well capitalized, okay,
you got enough
well
reserve,
managed, okay, it should all work out. But let's face it, it doesn't always work out. That's the shadow you might want to worry about.
I saw that you sent something around about cryptocurrencies and virtual currencies and Bitcoin and stuff like that. And I'm keen to get your thoughts on that. Are they the future? Do they have a place in the economy in the future or now even?
So
whatever happened to Bitcoin? Bitcoin was all the rage for several months, and
I think I've seen a lot published on. I'm going to throw out a few terms. So there's the general concept of virtual currency,
right?
And then let's talk about that before we talk about the other. So the other terms would be Bitcoin itself, and also blockchain. So you often hear these interchangeably. Yeah. They're not really interchangeable. Yeah. Let me describe essentially what they are. So virtual currencies, there is a movement.
Mm-hmm.
It's not an unreasonable movement to, when I say a movement, it's not some concerted action. Cash is inefficient.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Cash, I'm talking about the bills and the coins can be counterfeited. Passage of cash, it's very primal, right?
Yes.
It's a terribly inefficient way to conduct business. When you sort of step back, you go, if you were landing here from another planet, you'd say, what are these people exchanging?
Piece of paper,
It's no different. You saw a film, two cavemen exchanging stones. I think most aliens say, what in the world are they doing?
Yeah.
Okay, so there is the general view that cash is inefficient.
Mm-hmm.
Large bills facilitate drug and crime and the $500 bill or whatever.
Yeah.
You're going to go on and on. Yeah. Okay. So there is the general movement of the industry to cashless.
Mm-hmm.
Virtual currencies are one part of that. Okay, this idea of a virtual currency replacing cash. Now, that's in almost direct competition to monetary policy as we know it.
Mm.
So monetary policy, banks create money.
Yes.
Okay.
They print it, or they
I mean, every time a bank lends out money, you make a deposit, they lend out X percent, they hold some in reserve as mandated by the regulator.
And there's actually a
money creation thing. Nobody actually prints it. It's not a printing. It's just basically, voila, a debit into your account.
Yeah.
And off we go. Okay.
Yeah.
So this is an interesting addition to that mix of the notion of virtual currencies. So I'd encourage you. You can find all sorts of literature on what virtual currencies look like. Bitcoin was an example of a digital virtual currency.
Mm-hmm.
Money in general has certain criteria. It should be a store of value. Bitcoin.
Yeah.
You look at its history, not necessarily a good store of value. medium of exchange. Okay, could be a medium of exchange. There's the dark side, of course, of virtual currency, which the regulators are now focusing on.
The Silk Road thing. And
funding.
Money laundering and terrorism.
Okay. So the International Monetary Fund, Christine Lagarde now has a statement out about concerns they have, how they might regulate it. So the regulators are wondering, how do we regulate this? Bitcoin is an example of virtual currency, effectively. Now, blockchain is the technology that makes that possible.
Right.
So think of it as a transmission vehicle.
Yeah.
It's often used synonymously with the term distributed ledgers.
Okay.
Okay, that ability without a centralized point to conduct transactions, okay? So it's a technology. So they're not interchangeable. The way I'd virtually say it is Bitcoin is an example of a virtual currency. The concept of virtual currency is made possible by blockchain and technology.
Okay.
So I think you're going to see lots of... entrance into the space, consulting firms saying, oh, we can help you. We understand this technology.
Mm-hmm.
How could it be used? I think the regulators will enter saying, oh, we must regulate in the following way. So think about that. There are the benefits of moving to cashless.
Mm-hmm.
there are ways that a movement to cashless actually fosters monetary policy. So regulators are thinking, how would we incorporate that? How would we foster global commerce? Mm-hmm. And when I mean global commerce, people with really good, coming from a very good place, might say to you, they might say, Ben, if I could deliver mobile phones into Niger, the poorest country on the planet in Central Africa, you could actually bring the technology of blockchain through the mobile device, virtual currency and banking to Niger, wouldn't the world be a better place? Okay? I would argue technology improves life. Mm-hmm. That sounds like a good proposition for dealing with poverty, with development. Okay, but how do you do that responsibly and not end up having a situation where the regulators are saying, oh, it's funding
rebels in Niger or in Syria,
right?
Yeah.
So there's all these, but it's in its infancy. So the regulators, they're literally just now thinking about what does this mean?
Yeah, I mean, do you think some of the regulators or people in regulatory bodies are a bit scared about the loss of, potentially their relevance? I mean, libertarians love Bitcoin, or they used to anyway. I'm sure they love it as much, as they did given what's happened to it. But they love it because you can have a currency. You negate the need for a central bank. So all of a sudden, government has less of a role in the economy. And there's a limited number of these things in the world, and that's what we're going to use as money. Mm-hmm. And everything else will go bye-bye. Is that still a fear or a prospect, or do you think it'll look different from that view?
Yeah, I think, well, first of all, most of the world remains in the world of cash.
Yeah. Okay?
I think if you look at
total
transactions on the planet, globally.
Yeah.
Emerging markets developed, 85% volume is cash.
I was in the Philippines for a few weeks over Christmas, and everything's cash.
Okay. Yeah. So regulators are not quaking in their boots right now.
Yeah.
Interesting enough, I think large financial institutions like banks are moving closer to the regulator. Say, regulator, what do you think about virtual currency? Mm-hmm. Because the banks actually might view it as a threat.
Mm-hmm.
So who do you want on your side in that fight? You want the regulator. Mm-hmm. So suddenly you might find banks
working
more closely with regulators. Let's formulate policy on how to control this.
Interesting.
This sort of this technology. There's even the label people use the word fintech. You've probably seen this in newspapers. Fintech is just a big, broad umbrella of financial innovation, which blockchain technology is one example. Mm-hmm. Okay, digital. The broad name. Nobody even knows what digital means, right?
It's generally called fintech. Yeah. Okay.
And now it's all the rage. All the consultants are talking about fintech and how bankers can utilize fintech.
Okay.
For the next 10, 20 years.
Interesting. So. Interesting. Okay, well, we'll have to see how it plays out, but it's fascinating stuff. But at the end of the day, money is money, and in one way, shape, or form, and it's been going on for millennia. People have been trading.
I'd make a prediction. When you retire, you're not close. I know. When you retire, you'll retire in a cashless society.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
That's quite different from saying people are going to be on Bitcoin or something.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm just saying the movement to digital currency, not necessarily a specific type of like a Bitcoin solution. Mm-hmm. I just think that you won't be operating in cash anymore.
Okay.
You'll still have your sort code and your account code. It's just not going to... Everything's going to be through mobile devices,
which
is very different from virtual currency.
Right.
So there, you have to sort of look at it as stages. The elimination of cash and how that might potentially evolve in through the use of blockchain. And
virtual currency is just, you know, something is...
It's a competitor to
the dollar.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's a different variation. Yeah. So you kind of have to think about cashless does not mean virtual currency. Yeah. It's a step in that direction.
Right. Dinar or John Sterling or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Okay, that's interesting. Hard to wrap your head around, but the emerging market piece is also interesting because much of the world does not operates completely in cash or very close to it.
There's not a lot of banking service being delivered in Niger.
Yeah.
But think about crowdfunding for an irrigation well.
Yeah. And you know the way the mobile phone took Africa by storm, and it's sort of they bypassed landlines completely and just mobile phones. So that's and actually, come to think of it, you know, farmers are using mobile phones to make to sell their goods and without the cash or waiting for transfers.
Yeah, so imagine a farmer who could check market prices.
Yeah.
So the local. The local mill might discover, they've been sticking it to the local farmer. Oh, no, here's the actual market price for my product.
Right. Okay. Interesting. I did want to ask you about, it's a couple things, but before I do that, I wanted to ask you if you've seen this TED Talk by Didier Sornet on predicting financial crises.
No.
Okay. I'll put a link in the show notes, but...
Yeah, the prediction of financial crises.
This guy is seemingly a super, super smart. I think he's a geophysicist or something like this, and he applied some of these techniques to financial crises. But he used sort of a technique about feedback loops and all things that you can use to predict disease, glaciers melting or whatever into financial data, and he's saying that. We can now predict the next financial crisis by looking at what's happening in the peaks and troughs of prices and stuff like that.
I think I find myself much more in the Nassim Taleb camp.
Right.
So Nassim Taleb, author of The Black Swan and other books. I'm more in this camp.
Wonderful book.
Which is that the world is a complex... It's a very simple proposition. Yeah. The world is a complex place.
We don't know everything.
And there's no... Yeah, our limited... Our brains are not built to think long-term, to even think... It has natural biases. Mm-hmm. So consequently, any sort of prediction is just folly, right?
Okay.
Because we through genetics... we just have a natural. We see a tiger. We run sort of thing. We don't really think about the long term particularly well.
Yeah.
To our detriment.
Yeah.
Okay, but we're still surviving, right? So something's going well. I think Taleb's view, which one did I subscribe to, is well, what do you do in this world that's so complex you can't possibly understand?
Yeah.
How does one protect yourself financially, etc.?
Yeah.
It comes down to what would broadly be called. It falls under the banner of like tail hedging or other such terms, which is it's quite simple to say minimize
your exposure the downside.
To downside stuff, but open yourself to upside stuff. Yeah. Okay, but with a limited degree, right? So you might say, well, what does that actually mean? So Taleb, one of his favorite things is he says the upside is exposure to lots of people.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't watch television, apparently. Mm-hmm. He goes out a lot.
Mm-hmm.
He loves going to parties,
right.
Cocktail parties. He won't turn down an invitation. I actually once met Nassim at a book event.
Right.
And I was with some banking colleagues, and we invited him over. Of course we knew he would come.
Yeah.
Because he's exposed himself. What are you working with? Yeah. What do you do?
Right.
It's simply this interaction with people, exposing yourself to new ideas.
You never know, right?
Yeah, he runs into a broadcaster. Oh, I'd love to have you on. Suddenly there's an opportunity.
There's
something, there's more books to be sold.
Yeah, that's right.
It's exposing himself to the upside.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, limiting his exposure to the downside, not putting all of his eggs in one basket. He also has a thing, don't trust, it's good to see you don't have a tie on, don't trust anyone with a tie.
That's right.
Beware of anyone wearing a tie.
That's right. Yeah.
So
yeah.
These sort of... Now,
I think that's a wonderful way to live your life.
And yeah, this whole idea of predictions, it's a dangerous game because there's almost a reliance on models or the past as an indicator of the future.
That's right, yeah. This guy, Didier Sarnet, I listened to his TED Talk the other day, and he talked about black swans, and then he talked about his thing, which is called Dragon Kings. I won't get into what that means because I didn't quite understand it. But one of the things that he said, well, we don't have to worry about the black swan because we can predict this stuff and we can feel empowered again, or something to that effect. I thought that's really interesting because people like to hear predictions. They like to try to predict. And it is one of the reasons why, also in times of economic uncertainty, gurus are predictions and gurus are very popular. People love to predict. Well, what's the 1970s was a big boom for people that are predicting the future. Alvin Toffler and Future Shock, and people love that. Well, what's the world going to look like? And they want to latch onto that certainty. And sometimes I just wonder, how is that different from visiting the soothsayer in 100 years ago, or the witch doctor, or the whatever, and I much prefer Taleb's way of looking at the world, which is I don't know what's going to happen, but minimize.
The experts don't. And one recently in Davos, Switzerland, the World Economic Forum holds the who's who come to Davos, this little skiing resort, and it gets televised, and everyone's there: politicians, David Cameron, central bankers, Kevin Spacey, Leonardo DiCaprio. Yeah. I mean, everyone's Will I Am. Yeah. It was even hosting something, sort of hosting. Great quotes. Yeah. And every year they publish what's called the risk map.
The risk map. That's right.
Okay. Yeah. Now, interestingly enough, to this year's risk map, what was deemed the most acute risk: large scale migration. It's in the news.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. Yeah. Now, interestingly enough, if you go back to 24 months ago, 2 years ago, to the Davos, wasn't even on the map.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, the way I would approach that, the way black swan folk like Taleb would say, the world is a complex place. Beware of unintended consequences. Mm. So on that map, there was concern about geopolitical conflict. That is, how are we going to respond to Syria? Mm-hmm. Will we bomb? The West? What's Russia doing in Syria? Blah, blah, blah. It became this sort of geopolitical thing. Mm-hmm. Policymakers not realizing that dropping bombs have unintended consequences.
That's right.
Yep. Now, the reason we can't really go the soothsayer, that risk manifests itself as a knock-on effect from something that was on the map 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And the concern is naturally, there's what's going to hit us next, I'm guessing, isn't even on the map.
That's right.
But when you look at the map, you think everything's on there.
Yeah,
there's terrorism, pestilence, weather, but it's the unintended consequence that gets you. So what's the unintended consequence of migration? Nowhere on the map, I'll bring this up, is not a prediction, I'll just use an example. Nowhere on the map this year does it say, well, Prince William is probably where it's held, as a prominent risk, the breakup of the European Union.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. It's just not there. Mm. Okay, you might say, there's a little bubble that says political ramifications of something, right? But, something very crystal. Mm. So you could argue bombing Syria, unintended consequence of migration, Europe's inability to deal with it, causing a fracture in the European Union.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we've got a vote on Brexit in the UK coming up, and if people start to conflate the migration crisis with what's happening in the EU somehow, you never know.
Yeah. When people go, people often, if I go to a cocktail party, they go, "Oh, you work in banking? What do you do in banking? Are you a trader?" I'm like, "I work in risk." And many times they go, "Well, what's risk? I mean, what does that mean?" So I always use what I think is. There's a reason for me saying this is the best definition of risk I've ever come across. It's not even my own. It was someone from the Boston Consulting Group that said, I asked them, what is risk? I thought they were going to go, it's something that's two standard deviations, They said, shit happens.
Yeah, shit happens. That's great.
And I thought, wait a second. Because when American or Brit uses the term shit happens, excuse me, I said it again, what they're actually conveying is something that was unforeseen. Happened of unknown severity.
Yeah.
The past wasn't a good indicator of the future. Shit happened.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, the way I like to think about risk is sort of like the World Economic Forum thing we mentioned. Think about always the unintended consequence. We tend, as a human, we focus on, I see large scale migration. ask yourself that mental exercise. What might that lead to? Yes. What might be the consequences of that?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, we all say, oh, the consequences are there'll be a EU breakup, Brexit, or whatever.
Right.
Well, maybe that's not. Play out all the. It's almost like a bit in Monte Carlo.
Yeah.
You play out different paths, right?
Yeah.
And usually you get to some really weird places.
Mm.
Okay. I mean, recently, I think, was it Sweden said, oh, we need to deport 85,000 people?
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. How would that manifest itself? If there was a film a few years back with Clive Owen, Children of Men, which was based on a book.
Mm.
And it was a future London.
Mm.
And in this future of London, this this man in central London, there's acts of terrorism going on around him. He goes to the rail station. There are migrants in cages. Mm-hmm. And when the film came out, probably about 10 years ago, people said, this is a future. How shocking. I can't imagine such a place, but it's great film. We're so close to that.
Yeah.
That I think that if you see that film again... You think to yourself, wow, this sort of unintended consequence, you know, it's just something that's we have to think about and risk. We're never going to, because they're black swans they're black swans. Yeah. You can't
predict them. And this is where it's hard for people sometimes to wrap their heads around this, is that you're not trying to predict these things, but just thinking about what could happen so that you just protect yourself, whether that might, that might be a personal choice, right? So about, changing a job or, a personal investment choice or a relationship choice even, as long as you know what could happen and you're prepared to, you've got
we can all do things to minimize the downside. Everyone knows through the history of leverage financially, is exposing yourself to the downside.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I know I'm not here to preach about personal indebtedness, but that's one avenue where people go,
no, stay out of debt.
I'm going to pay off X.
That's right. You're going to pay off the visa.
I'm going to live in a smaller
house.
I'm not going to over-mortgage myself. Yeah. These are prudent actions.
That's right. Yeah.
If you happen to be in a family or relationship where there's two breadwinners, you might say that's also an action of minimizing the downside. Diversification, right?
Yeah.
So, people still gravitate to marriage as an economic contract, even.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing wrong with that. People go, oh, it's not romantic with Valentine's Day coming up. But, I mean, it's a pretty serious matter, marriage.
Yeah.
Should probably be dictated by understanding that it is an economic partnership, okay? It should inherently also be part of love and partnership.
Yeah. Yeah.
Black swan, minimize your risk of the black swan, right? Expose yourself to good stuff.
Yeah.
Okay? Don't. That's probably good advice. Don't go home and simply watch the telly. Expose yourself to culture, to other people, to your neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, positive things come from that.
Yeah.
Just even if it's simply being a happier person.
That's right. That's right.
So you can live Talib. There's no rule book, and you can probably get through life reasonably well. But we're all going to be hit with black swans.
Yeah, shit will happen.
Recently, there was a Danish film that came out. It was a black comedy, but the plot was that there's a gentleman in Copenhagen, and he Belgium. It was a Belgian film. And
what was the name of the film?
I'm trying to recall. The Last Testament.
Oh, okay, right.
It was called The Last Testament. It had a Belgian title. Yeah. It was at the British Film Festival.
Right.
And the concept of the film, there's a man in Brussels who is God. He doesn't look like what you'd imagine. I don't know what God's supposed to look like, but this guy just walks around in his bathrobe and has a room in his flat, and he actually is God. Yeah. And his daughter goes in the room and presses a button, and everyone is informed via their mobile device of what their date of death is.
Mm.
Like, you will die on X day. Yes. He gives you the date and the hour.
Mm.
And people begin to react accordingly.
Mm.
Reason I bring this up is it's kind of interesting to play through a risk lens of, like, how would we... Because we always go, oh, we need to understand risk. What's the next risk that's coming up? But how would we really react to that?
Yeah.
What behaviors would that spawn that wouldn't be particularly healthy? Mm. So one character in the film, this young fellow, he's going to live till he's 90, so he puts himself in peril. He, like, throws himself off of a bridge only to land on a barge of soft flour that's coming by. So I wonder, like, if you actually knew what the World Economic Forum, what the real materialization of risk would be, I'm going to suggest, after what I saw that film, that it would cause really unsound and bad behavior. So embrace the uncertainty, because think about it, how would you behave if you actually knew the date of your death? I'm guessing it may not be the right kind of behavior, right?
It depends on the. I'm sure it would depend on the date. If it was in closer proximity, I would.
It would cause one sort of incentive of maybe overconsumption of
possibly, or it could. You know, it could. I've always wanted to tell this person that thing, or whatever. Some unforeseen circumstances. You never know, right?
Don't know their date of death, right? So. There's one certainty, death and taxes, right?
Sure.
So when people go, John, you work in risk, I really need, for our bank, I need to really kind of have an understanding of what's going on. I always go, well, let's think about this. Do you really, what would certainty mean to your behavior?
I think it would make for a dull existence, to be honest. I think it just, I don't think I could stand it. Because you don't know. I mean, I love that sort of, you know, that's what makes life worth living, is when you've got that uncertainty and it makes things exciting.
The ultimate risk, though. We generally we fear death.
Okay? Yes.
Even if we believe in an afterlife, they're still like, oh, there's the unknown. You know, how's that going to go? Yeah. And so it's the ultimate risk. And when we say, oh, we want risk-free, really?
You can't live risk-free.
No.
I mean, that doesn't make any sense.
The fact you get out of bed, get on transport, conveyed that life is not priceless.
Yes.
People go, life is priceless. Actually, no. The fact that you've got up, got in a car, bus, you've actually, with your feet, basically said, life is not priceless. Mm-hmm. I'm willing to take a risk.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to go. Imagine, I'm taking a risk to go to a box in an office. Why do we do it? There's money, there's friendship, there's camaraderie in the office. It's the act of doing something. We're built to do things, right? Even if it's filing, even if it's, trading, think about it. What is that? I'm trading something that I can't touch with another party.
Yeah, I mean, I think, and that's, it's good to think about these things like this. So I think for a lot of people, you know, they don't want to be in a box in an office. But they're there because of perhaps, you know, they're tied down with whether it's a mortgage or you know, an expensive lifestyle or whatever, and that's why they're there. And that's that, you know, that you don't want to be in that place. And actually, you know, I'm thinking about some colleagues who are in rather prominent positions, and you know, they don't, you know, they sort of tie themselves. It becomes, it's leverage, right? So you can leverage yourself with whatever. You know, it doesn't have to be just money.
The comedian George Carlin, also I think the German comedian Henning Bang, often
George Carlin's awesome.
They basically convey that, you know, if you look at the distribution of children that are born, most of them are just going to be average. Right?
That's right.
And Henning Bang went so far as to basically parents should just sit down with their children and largely just say, about all you can hope for is a role in middle management, right, at some point. That's as good as it gets.
God.
And embrace that. Yeah. So you're not all going to be astronauts. You're not all princes.
No.
But basically say, we're all pretty much built to be in middle management.
Oh,
right?
God. Oh, you're depressing me, John. but yeah, I mean, I think we've been going on for a little bit, but maybe sort of wrap this thread up. I mean, I think it's important that you can still middle management is not necessarily a bad thing, but you know, don't attach your whole identity to being a middle manager. And there's all kinds of wonderful things outside of, you know, outside of whatever it is you're doing. But I love that thing about, you know, avoiding leverage, putting yourself in the position of upside, and embracing that uncertainty, I think is just a wonderful way to live any life. Was there anything else on your mind, John?
Well, I hopefully I've tried to represent investment banking in a reasonable way.
No, this is great. I mean, I was thinking
I put on my first
episode. I said we're going to talk about risk and uncertainty and all these things apply to all kinds of domains, except perhaps the corporate one, which because it's kind of dull and people work in it anyway.
But what you're doing is quite valuable because people have started to see there's links between how we manage risk in a bank versus something. Here in Britain, we have Major Tim, who's in the space station.
Yes.
Traveling around the Earth or whatever. I'm not a space person. But I think it's kind of fascinating. NASA and the European Space Authority, they have risk management functions.
That's right. Yeah.
They define it very differently. Yeah. The mission is successful if nobody dies, right?
Yeah.
If the apparatus returns,
sure,
as it should, or behaves.
Yeah.
So they have a very different threshold. But they're simply principles that are applied in the space concept, right?
The principles apply to I think just everybody the space concept, which is gets really interesting because it's so complicated. But in the personal context as well, and I think it's just a fascinating topic and way to explore it. But what I was going to say was, I expressly wanted to stay away from lots of corporate stuff, but I'm going to have John Morrison on my podcast because you can express these things in a way that you make investment banking sound really interesting, which is, not an easy thing to do.
Those of us who are in it, there's certain elements that are just fun. It is at its heart fun. And also, anyone in investment banking, I'm going to expand this, anyone working happily in London.
Yes.
I mean, you're just incredibly lucky. Okay, you could be somewhere else. But Ben, you're working in London.
This is a wonderful place.
Maybe some people listening to this podcast are living in New York, London, these great cities of the world. They also might be in some remote place. That's great, too.
Yeah.
Okay, just to embrace where you are, because I think we're pretty lucky here in central London.
We are. No, absolutely. And if you're not, expose yourself to the upside.
Central
London. wherever that may be for you, but, give yourself the opportunity that might happen. I think we've covered quite a lot of ground, so I don't want to hold you any more, but I wanted to thank you very much for coming on. Really enjoyed the conversation, and we will have you on again.
Appreciate it. Thanks.
Thanks, John.
Thanks.
Well, I hope that you both enjoyed that and that you perhaps learned a few things. Maybe you came away with a different perspective on the world of investment banking. Then again, maybe not. But either way, it'd be great to hear from you. So you can send me feedback directly, allthingsrisk@gmail.com, or leave a comment in the comment section in the allthingsrisk.com website. Thank you to those who have given me feedback on the show. It's just great to hear from you. I do the show as a labor of love, a little bit of an excuse to interview interesting people like John, but it's great to know that people are listening. And the show will always be free, but it's wonderful to hear that people are indeed listening. And also, a great way to spread the word is to provide a rating or a review on iTunes. It helps the show get noticed. I'm not quite sure how the algorithm in iTunes works, but the more ratings you have, good ratings, the more that it kind of bumps the show up in terms of getting noticed. And do subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher if you have not yet done so. However you get your audio content, we're on various formats, so you should be able to get a hold of the show. Do share it with friends if you enjoy the show or specific episodes. Follow us on Twitter @RiskThings is the Twitter handle. We are going to have some great episodes coming up. A little bit different in terms of theme, and I'll just provide a hint, geographic location in terms of the content and the stories. But certainly the themes of randomness and risk underscore it, and I think you'll really enjoy some of the interviews that I have up and coming. So stay tuned for those. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you soon. A new episode will be up next week. Stay tuned for that. In the interim, don't forget, risk is life.